I'm Nick Hobbs and welcome along to Off the Canvas, a boxing podcast centred around mental health. Today, our guest is broadcaster Mr. Chris Lloyd. So Chris, we're catching up a few days after the first Matchroom show in the UK, which is a very, very busy time for you. Did you enjoy yourself?
Yeah, it was really good, mate. Looked after for Ted Cheeseman, obviously, because, you know, you can't afford his ambition, but I think he just didn't have enough at that level. And I think we're kind of getting around to the idea now that we need to stop taking some of these fans' minds a little seriously, and, you know, we are guilty as a cohort, some sort of underrated European fights, some good records, and you know, good papers here, and we watched a couple of fights, you know, about it, but actually, there's more and more proof that there's more and more substance to these guys than you think, and I think there was a great gap between British and European level than we acknowledged, certainly in the last few years. So I think it's time for the fans as well to start realising that whilst they're calling for the next wave of upcoming fighters, whether it's Fouazzi, Kelly, Fowler, Aldina, etc., to be moved quicker, that people like Lewis Richardson, that makes it, and of course Ted Cheeseman have proved that if you move people too quickly, that's when they come unstuck, and there's a reason why the process in place is as it is, as it has been for a long time.
And now, just a little preamble there, we were talking about boxers always get asked when you're going to fight for a world title. Doesn't matter who they are.
Yeah.
They, you know, they get on TV and everyone's saying, well, what's the plan? How long can we expect you to be in a world title fight? Some of them haven't even won British titles.
No.
But then there's a huge step up between British titles and European titles, isn't there? I think that was probably on show on Saturday night.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, look, there's nothing wrong with taking something a little bit too early. I mean, look at Charlie Edwards with Rosales. I mean, he wouldn't have, without the experiences of Casimiro and Rosales, you know, you can't have one without the other. And so his experience loses one through valuable in victory over the other. And so I think as long as we get rid of the stigma attached to the O on somebody's record, I think that's one of the things that we're still working on. And I think fighters start to come around to it. That's not so much of a problem step up and lose, why did you learn lessons from it and then show your improvements going forward. So somebody like Ted Cheeseman or Lewis Richardson, the next 6 to 8 months tells us how much they've actually learned from that defeat. And you look at someone like Isaac Chamberlain last year, losing to Lawrence Coley, you know, props to him for taking that fight early, moved over to Angel Fernandez, made some amazing adjustments and came back a completely renewed fighter against Luke Watson. So there are real benefits to it long term. It's just obviously difficult when you know these guys, you see the setback in the initial instance, you do feel for them, because for us it's entertainment, but for them it's their livelihood, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd imagine one of the, just looking from the outside, one of the coolest parts of your job and one of the kind of privileges is spending time with the fighters in the build up to fight, so you get quite close to them, I imagine. Have you spoken to Ted at all since the fight?
No, I haven't spoken to him. I've spoken to Tony Sims briefly, just to kind of see how he is, and I think he's okay. He's just, you know, somebody that tough, the bruises are kind of skin deep, really. I think it's more, you know, the implications of what the setback means in terms of, you know, the potential Fowler fight and everything else. It must be really difficult to take. But, I mean, Ted disappeared, didn't he, straight away after? I was really, really upset, and I think he'll need a couple of weeks before he thinks about talking to the press, and that's his right. You know, he worked so, so hard, and I got to see window into their camp a couple of weeks ago, filming one of the promos for it, and yeah, the graph that goes in is absolutely savage. And I think, you know, when you put that much in, dedicate that much, it reflects in the kind of performance it was from him. It was workmanlike, to say the least. And when you pour so much in, you feel like you've had no reward. I mean, it just must be so devastating for him. So I just hope he can have a month or so's rest, get his body healed, and then just, you know, have a look back at the fight, learn what the mistakes were, and then move on from it. But yeah, like I say, it's a privilege. It's great to get to know these guys. It humanises them. I guess the beauty of that is when they have good moments and victories, you get to celebrate that and you feel it on a personal level. But when they have defeats, it does hit you harder than it were if you just a fan watching at home.
Getting so close to them, have you found that the way you see boxing, the way you see these fighters, has that changed quite a lot?
Yeah, it has. I suppose your emotional involvement in their careers becomes heightened because you see them as people, not just as fighters. So you realise, you know, because we kind of held them, don't we, to an extent. when you watch them on TV. They're sort of superhuman.
Yeah, they do the things that we can't do.
Yeah, absolutely. And the bravery and the poise with which they manage what they do for a living is remarkable. I mean, and often I'm with the camera, you know, standing next to them when they're just about to walk through the curtain, and you feel the pressure just by extension of being there, and you think what it's like to have to get in the ring and fight some of the toughest men in the world in front of thousands in an arena, and then, you know, infinitely more watching at home. It's remarkable what they do, and you can only have, like, just a profound respect for them. And I wish I had anything like that bravery.
What's the most nervous you've been for a fighter?
I get nervous before David Price's fight and Josh Boatley's fight. David Price, been good friends for about 3 or 4 years. We have a friendship almost exclusively on Alan Partridge quotes, which is mad because he doesn't come across like your typical Partridge fan, but he loves it. So there's that, and I guess with Price, you know, we all know his kind of vulnerability. So for me, it's that's the thing I fear the most, and I get nervous for him because I want him to do well as well. But Boatley's a different kind of fish because he seems completely invincible at the moment, and it doesn't seem like anything is insurmountable for him. But by the same merit, he's a very, very good friend of mine. We've been very close for a long time, so I feel personally completely invested and involved in his career, and I film a lot of it as well. So I film the good and I film the bad, but you know, you can film everything up until the point where the ring walk happens, and then he's on his own, and at that point, you feel for those few minutes that his fights actually last. I mean, most of them fit in a Snapchat story, but he's on his own and there's nothing you can do to help him. So, yeah, it's a real privilege, but it is on fight night, I do find it stressful. Yeah.
Why boxing, Chris? Why did you get into the sport?
My granddad boxed. I remember we watched, the first fight I ever watched was Bruno McCall in 1995, so I would have been about, 8 years old.
Mm.
And I remember watching it thinking, this is a bit like wrestling, but there's something not quite right about it. And then just falling in love with it. And unfortunately, watching Bruno versus Tyson 2, thinking Frank Bruno was sort of impervious to anything. He was like a superhero, and then Tyson blew him away, died around or whatever it was. And then just that kind of era, Nassim Hamed, the sort of late part of Chris Eubank and Nigel Benn's careers as well, I picked up when I was probably 11, 12. And, I absolutely fell in love with it. Like everyone does, you get the bug, yeah, and it stays with you. And it never occurred to me that I would work in the sport. But, you know, here we are, 31 years later, I am.
When did you start working in boxing?
It was the first ever gig I got in boxing. I was doing sort of small hall commentaries and things of that nature. But I was at university, so I met my best mate, the first day of uni, and he was a professional kickboxer at the time, and he was sponsored, but he'd gone to Loughborough Uni, as I had, to kind of partly pursue sport, but also to get a decent degree in case it didn't work out.
Mm.
So he was the person, really, that said to me, look, you know, you could go and work in a bank, or you could try and do something, you know, make a sacrifice for 4 or 5 years, and end up doing something you love for the rest of your life. So we'd watch, like, bootleg DVDs of old fighters. I remember, like, watching, there was hundreds of amateur fights for people like Ray Mercer and Roy Jones, Floyd, Evander Holyfield, James Toney, like the US Olympic team of the 80s and 90s.
Right.
And just falling in love with it and understanding so much about it from him. And then we were sparring together. And later down towards the end of our time at uni, we helped set up the Loughborough Boxing Club. And it was, for me, he was one of the people who said, look, why don't you try and work your way into the boxing industry? So 22, 23, the BBC were hiring presenters for the Olympics. I went for the job and ended up getting it, and then ended up working on the boxing for 18 days. So I saw, you know, Gogo, Nicola Adams, Luke Campbell, and of course Big AJ winning his gold on the very last day. So from there, it was just kind of anything and anything I could pick up, you know, working on the small hall circuit, going through reports, keeping standards, doing some articles for them, and just sort of couch surfing for 4 or 5 years, just getting whatever money I had together to go to the next press conference and the next event and to network. And, he was, my friend Chris was one of the people that always, you know, believed in me wholeheartedly. You know, he'd always said, look, keep working, back. I've got my rewards.
Right. In those 7 years, say, how have you seen the conversation of mental health within the sport change or even emerge, as it was?
Yeah, it's been remarkable. I think there was virtually no dialogue around it, I would say, 6 or 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that's not to do any disservice to people who are trying to make their mark in the subject, but I think it hasn't really come to wider public consciousness and been accepted and kind of soaked in probably until about 18 months ago. Mm-hmm. There seems to be real movement. And I think a lot of that comes from the top down. It takes a couple of breakthrough figures to sort of jolt people into action. I think Prince Harry opening up and talking about his experience with mental health after his mum passed away was incredibly helpful. I think people like The Rock, who've obviously got a monstrous following in the world of sport and entertainment, him opening up about his battle with depression in the early years was key too. And then I think that filters down and it comes all the way down to everyone that's making contributions on any level. So whether it's you and I doing this today, maybe that sparks 4 or 5 extra conversations and that inspires somebody to then go and get counselling or seek help or ask their friend if everything's okay. And that ripple effect is like paying it forward, isn't it? There's real momentum around it, but I think it's so important that we don't just think, great, job done. We need to keep that momentum going, and the way to do that is by talking.
Can you remember the first time a boxer mentioned mental health issues to you or made a reference to it at all?
There's a couple that have him in private that I wouldn't want to mention without their sort of say so. I can, of course, remember hearing of Darren Sutherland passing. I think it was, I want to say, 07, 08, around then. And again, not really understanding, because at that point, you know, I was at university and you got your whole life ahead of you. You don't have any worries at that point. Your time's your own and you're just having fun. And so I remember hearing something like that, thinking, wow, that's what happened in his life to lead to that. But the more time has gone on, you understand that sometimes nothing has to happen. You can just be ill. Mm. And that's okay. I think sometimes we're so busy trying to justify. We're very scientific beings in that we like to look at cause and effect. So this has happened, why did it happen? But sometimes there isn't a reason. And I think that the more we understand that with mental health, the better equipped we are to be able to understand when somebody says, I'm really struggling today. It doesn't have to be, why are you struggling? It can just be, okay, I understand. That's the point where we need to get to. And so I guess, you know, standout examples like Darren Sutherland that happened, I think had that happened in this era, we would be far more understanding rather than asking quite so many questions about it.
Is it particularly poignant to you when you hear fighters talk about it, because from the outside, these are the mentally strongest, toughest, bravest people I spend time with.
Yeah.
But yet, they kind of internally, there can be this ongoing dilemma and, you know, mental health crisis going on that they somehow have to compartmentalize and manage to then go out there. And as you said before, they get to take their tops off, they get on the shorts, and they go out and fight the hardest men in the world.
Yeah, you're spot on. I also think part of the reason that it's so difficult for the fighters to open up is that they spend so much of their life lying to us. And I don't mean that in a negative way. What I mean is, while you get footballers pretend to be injured and, you know, promoters pulling the wool over our eyes, boxers are consistently telling us, I'm not hurt, training camp's gone great, everything's fine, I love my job. I mean, we know it's nonsense, because if you've ever watched a boxer train for any length of time, it's a really grim, hard life. I mean, there's no glamour to it whatsoever. No. And we sort of forget that, you know, that one night under the lights with the pyro and the crowds and the lights and everything, they've still got to fight. You know, that's our entertainment, but that's what it all accumulates to for them. And so I think because they're constantly having to perpetuate the lie, because that's part of the game, you can't give away your vulnerability. You can't tell people, yeah, I was terrified then, or I was nervous, or this or that. Remember George Foreman at 67, 68 years of age, saying, I've never told anyone this before. When I came face to face with Joe Frazier before we fought, I was absolutely terrified. It's like I feel my legs shaking. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, my God, I hope the TV doesn't pick up how much my legs are shaking. I thought, that's George. George Foreman, like,
yeah,
one of the top three most feared fighters of all time. You put him up there with Sonny Liston and Mike Tyson. George Foreman, for flip's sake. So if he can say that,
yeah,
and it's taken him 40 years past his fighting best to open up about something like that, that tells you everything. And I think, so you're bang on, that's one of the dilemmas that fighters have to wrestle with, that their walls and their barriers have been put so high up that, you know, for most of us, it's hard to bring the barriers down. For them, their barriers are even higher than ours.
Mm. Why is this such an important issue for you, Chris?
Well, for me, I lost my best mate to suicide. It would be 3 years ago this month, on the 27th. He was the chap that I met at Loughborough, my best mate. He was the guy that supported me through, you know, the last 7-8 years of hard work to get to where I am in my career. He was one of my real sort of the cornerstones of my life, you know, my best friend. And I had no idea he was struggling. And I can remember the morning that I got a call. He was out in Australia doing some travelling. And it was the morning after the Frampton Quigg fight. So I was around the house with a promoter, a load of fighters, and we were all up having breakfast and a bit of banter and stuff. And then this message comes through, and suddenly the whole world sort of collapses and changes forever, really. You never go back to how things were before that point. And it took me a long time to recover from that. You know, I would say it's only been the last 12 months that things have started to kind of get back to normal, and I feel like I've got a semblance of normality. And through all of it, it's been a huge, hugely traumatic experience. It's been a great learning curve. I found out about, I guess, 18 months to 2 years ago, about 2 years ago, that I actually had PTSD as a result of what happened, and so I had treatment for that. But it, you know, as horrible as the experience was, I kind of wouldn't have learnt the lessons that I've learned without it, and I wouldn't be in the position that I am to be able to talk about mental health and to be able to understand it in the way that I do. And so, yeah, you know what, from a completely selfish point of view, if I could go back and just have him back, mm-hmm, I would do it in a heartbeat. I'd give up my whole career and work in Tesco for the rest of my life if I could have him back without even consideration.
We had Charlie Duffield was on the podcast a few months ago, and his brother committed suicide. And his brother was very unwell, and he was on suicide watch, and it was a very kind of stretched out, prolonged period of trauma and stress for Charlie while this was going on, and it came to a conclusion in such a horrible way. Was that the same kind of case with your friend here? Was he someone you were worrying about?
No, completely the opposite. He was flying in life. I think that was what was the shock that was, you know, if you had to make a list of your friends that you would be concerned about on any level, he would have been at the very, very bottom of the list.
Mm-hmm.
He had it all, just smart, happy, great looking guy, brilliant prospects in life. I mean, he was just top of his game on the surface. And I think that was one of the things that made me realise how serious mental health problems are, because they don't discriminate between class or wealth or social status or happiness. It can just be that if they decide to get you, they get you. And I think we're so busy, like, it's kind of cause and effect, but we also look at someone's life and we think, well, they look great, therefore they must have it easy, or they have lots of money, therefore they must be happy. It doesn't really work like that if you have a mental health problem. Mm-hmm. The other stuff becomes completely, it's invisible to you. And for Chris, clearly, we weren't at a point where he really felt he could open up to everybody. I know his parents were aware of a few things that were going on, having spoken to them since, but I had no clue. And I wrapped my brain back to the conversations we had, and I've gone through all the old messages and voice notes, but there's no indication at any point, and he's one of the best friends I've ever had, that there were any issues going on. And so, for me, that has made it even more important to make sure that we keep the platforms and that the airways open for everybody to feel like they can talk. And that's why I talk about the problems I had with PTSD and how it manifested themselves. And that's why I encourage anybody to just open up and talk about them in the same way you talk about a broken leg or a bad day at the office. Just talk, because you'll be surprised at how many other people share your sentiments and thoughts, but they keep them in secret. But as soon as you open up and give people a platform to do so, you'd be surprised at how cathartic that process is and how much you kind of benefit yourself, and that how much your friends and people around you can benefit from talking.
I think when people think of PTSD, the first thing they'd think of would be someone who served in the armed forces.
Yeah.
I think that's what people's heads, certainly I know that's what my mind would first go to. So yeah. Could you kind of explain how that manifested with you, Chris, and what that was like?
Yeah, so the day that I got the news, I mean, one of the crudest ways to explain PTSD, as far as I understand it, and there'll be people far more qualified than I, but you ultimately have a fight or flight response to something that puts you in a dangerous situation. So if you and I are sitting in a lounge and a lion walks in, your brain goes, well, I'm not going to fight that, I'm going to run to safety. And it floods your body with chemicals that heighten your alert, your heightened senses, your stress levels go through the roof, your heart pumps, and it gives you the energy you need to either fight or to run for as long as you need to run to get to safety. And it's not until you get to safety that your body switches that sort of production of chemicals and things off that brings your normal kind of hormone levels and everything back to baseline so that you can recover. And so if you're in a kind of a military situation, if you're under fire and hold up for several days, your senses never switch off. And essentially that switch can kind of get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what then leaves you with PTSD. And so when people in the armed forces come back, things can trigger them. So it could be loud noises, it could be people crying, it could be a certain smell. Anything associated with the time that you were in amongst that stress, whether it's any sort of sensory information, sight, smell, sound, it can trigger panic attacks, flashbacks, anxiety, anything at all, and send you completely off the rails in what would otherwise be a very, very normal social situation. Now, for me, unfortunately, it took a good 24 hours before we had confirmation of Chris's death. The first things that came through were people in Australia who'd found me on Facebook and had sent these kind of ambiguous messages about, have I heard the news?
Mm-hmm.
Did I know anything? And the panic and the fear that you go into is completely off the chart, because you're praying that it isn't what you think it is, but deep down you kind of know something's very, very horribly wrong. And it then took about 5 or 6 hours before we then had confirmation that they thought they'd find a body. It was then another 5 or 6 hours before it was confirmed it was Chris's. And I didn't sleep for 24 hours waiting for this news. And then the way his body was found, there was also kind of to-ing and fro-ing as to whether he'd been killed or whether he'd taken his own life. And during that time, nothing switched off. And there were lots of things that happened throughout that day. Really innocuous things, like I remember queuing for train tickets at a station, trying to get back to one of my mates' house to plug my phone in so I could be available for any calls that were coming in. And there was a queue of 4 people, and there was a lady on the phone in front of me just dilly-dallying, which is normally not an issue at all, because I'm very laid back with life, but it was stressing me out to a huge degree. And for about 18 months, any time I looked at a train ticket or saw a ticket machine or stood in a queue at the post office, I remember having a massive, like, flashback, and then almost coming to, and just sort of having an anxiety attack in the middle of the post office. I remember an old lady looking at me and saying, "Are you okay, sweetheart?" And I thought, I'm not okay.
Yeah.
And all those things, that affect you so badly. And when you're trying to hold down a career and you're trying to go about your day-to-day life as normal, made life incredibly difficult. So that was how it affected me personally.
When you talk about those triggers, I really hope this doesn't come across as flippant, but it was the day after the Carl Frampton fight.
Yeah.
That's right. You're now doing a podcast with Carl. I'm not trying to be funny or anything like that. Was there any concern for you there, or was it something you talked to him about?
I mentioned it to Carl. I think Carl lost a friend a little while ago, and I messaged him, and we were just chatting about it, because, sometimes it's nice to open the floor to someone if they've lost a mate, because not always easy to talk to people, and I sometimes find that it helps talking to somebody who's been through the same thing. So I try, and sometimes if anyone's unfortunately in that position, I offer themselves up. And I did mention it, so I said, oh, it was the morning after your fight with Quigg. But no, for me, that wasn't one of the triggers, I guess, because it all happened after that.
Right, that wasn't the period of stress when the fight was going on.
No, I guess the only thing that fight serves as a kind of reminder of, of the date and the kind of memory of the date. So it would be, as I say, 3 years on the 27th, I think they fought on the, must have been the night of the 26th. But yeah, I mean, no, you're right to ask that, because honestly, it can be the most innocuous of things that can trigger. And it took quite a while. I went through therapy, and it took a while to work out what all the triggers were. I had to go through, had to walk back through the day in really great detail. And just a kind of almost like deprogramming process. Once you've realised what the triggers are, you acknowledge them, you kind of talk them through. And then it's like, at some point, they stop becoming triggers. And there's always reminders and things. I always look at things and I think, yeah, I remember that, but you know, no longer do I get the kind of flashbacks and the anxiety and everything. So I'm very, very lucky, because I'm aware that a lot of PTSD sufferers sometimes don't make full recoveries. And I would say, although there are certainly times where I have little resurgences of things and anxieties and stuff like that, by and large, I feel, you know, almost like a new man, given what I was 2 years ago.
What do you think you've learned about mental health in the last 3 years before this all happened?
I've learned that we need to believe people, and I've learned that we need to be open to this being a real thing. And I think when you're talking to somebody about mental health, when you're asking them, I think, and certainly this is a message, I think, more to men than to women, and I don't mean to generalise, but I do think this is important, because men are a little bit, we like to try and fix problems, and sometimes mental health isn't something that can be fixed. And just being there, just being present, and making someone that is struggling aware that you are present and there for them whenever they need to talk is enough. You don't need to find a solution for that person. Being someone they can talk to and offload on is often more than enough. And I think sometimes we're kind of problem solvers, maybe just from the generations before us that had, you know, the way we've been divided in sort of conjugal roles. We'd, you know, the man in the house fixing things as they went wrong. And so we have this innate desire to, if there's a problem, what can we do about it? But with mental health, sometimes there isn't a great deal that can be done about it. So just listen, ask questions. Ask open questions. Ask people, how does it make you feel? When do you tend to feel the worst? Just be open, and then listen, let people speak, and take in what they're saying. And I think the more we do these things, the more you and I talk, the more you interview people, and the more people that open up in public, the better this is going to get. And there's a totally different conversation on the available services that we have publicly and the pressure that's on those. That's something for another day. But in terms of what we can do for each other, I think it's just to care, to be open, and to not be afraid to ask.
Can I ask one thing? Sorry, going back to your friend. How often were you talking to him when he was in Australia?
He'd been in Australia for, I think, about 4 months. And we were speaking just via message probably every couple of weeks.
Was he often putting updates on social media or anything like that? Or
yeah, he was. And he was often out partying, he was with beautiful girls, he was training people out there, boxing training. And he was just in the sun, surrounded by people, looking like he was having the time of his life.
Has this all changed the way you look at social media?
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite a cynic with social media anyway. And I have Twitter. I'm not on Instagram or anything like that. I've got Twitter because it serves as my kind of source of news for the world of boxing. But I could happily live without it. It doesn't really do anything for me. And I've always been aware that people pitch an idealized version of themselves to the world, and it's perpetuated by other people doing the same thing. And so we're in this kind of spiral where almost the worse your life is, the better you need to make it look like it is.
Yeah.
And it's really sad that we're in that. And I think everyone's aware of it. I do think the majority of people are aware of it. But it's hard to get out of that now, because once you're in that deep, you've got the facade to maintain and to keep up. So people will turn up to events just to get a picture at that event. They'll go to a beach just to get a photo at the beach. And actually what you're seeing is nothing like what the reality is day to day. We all have a cry now and again. We all sit and lounge looking horrible watching Netflix. There's never, no one lives a perfect life, contrary to what your social media following would suggest. And so, again, it's really important to not judge anyone by the pictures that you see, by the posts that you read, and to actually, when you see people, ask them, you know, and ask again. Sometimes you can say, how are you doing? And people go, yeah, good, thanks. Ask them again, so how are you actually doing? Because, you know what, some people are fine, and that's great, but sometimes, when you ask a second time, it gives somebody a license to say, oh, well, actually, I've had a bad week, or this has happened, or that's happened. And suddenly the floor's then open for them, just to let off a little bit of steam. And that can just create a really strong bond between you and somebody else, where they just feel like, okay, I have a safe space with that person now, without any judgment, to just tell them what's happening in my life, beyond the superfluous sort of pleasantries that we always pass to each other day to day. It goes a lot deeper than that. So I think if you can remember and you get the opportunity, ask people. But if you think you see anything in their eyes, just ask them again. Nothing wrong with asking twice.
Chris Lloyd, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. Fantastic stuff.
Thank you very much.
Great to hear from Chris there. Very sad, very interesting to hear what his friend went through, and subsequently the ordeal that he's been through in the last few years and the lessons he's learnt. Now, around 1 in 4 people will experience a mental health problem this year, yet the shame and silence can be as bad as the mental health problem itself. For more information on help that's available, please visit timetochange.org.uk. And thanks again for listening to Off the Canvas.